Welcome to the Food Revolution Summit, where we explore how you can heal your body and your world with food. This is Ocean Robbins, and I am joined by my dad and colleague, John Robbins, in welcoming our guest, Dr. Christy Funk. Christy Funk, MD, is a board-certified breast cancer surgeon and physician. She's the best-selling author of Breasts, an Owner's Manual. And she is an international keynote speaker, a women's health advocate, and she practices as a surgical breast specialist at the Pink Lotus Breast Center in Los Angeles. She excels as an expert in minimally invasive diagnostic and treatment methods for all types of breast disease. Christy has helped thousands of women through breast cancer treatment, including well-known celebrities like Angelina Jolie and Sheryl Crow. She hosts the Cancer Kicking Powwow podcast and the Cancer Kicking Summit. Her research and work have led her to become a passionate advocate for a healthy diet and lifestyle to prevent cancer. She wants to keep you healthy, well, and out of the operating room. So now, Christy, my dad and I are thrilled to have this time with you. And now for this interview, I'm going to hand it over to my dad and colleague, John Robbins.
Well, thank you, Ocean, for that introduction. And thank you, Christy, for being with us once again.
Thank you, John and Ocean. It's my privilege.
Well, it is ours as well. You know, Christy, you are certainly one of the most renowned breast cancer surgeons in the world today. But having read your book and having had the privilege of spending time with you, I have the sense that you would probably love nothing better than to put yourself out of a job as a surgeon if you could help women to prevent breast cancer in the first place. So what I want to ask you is, first of all, is that true? And if it is, what has led you to be so focused on prevention when Western medicine so often is not?
What a great question. And it's accurate to say that I would love nothing else than to put myself out of business as a breast cancer surgeon and then into business as essentially a very well-researched doctor who approaches disease and the maximal risk reduction thereof through dietary and lifestyle interventions that are so actionable, so take it home from this interview and start right now, easy to implement and have such massive health implications on a cellular level inside your body, which then in turn almost immediately becomes a macro level. When you are healthy, your relationships are healthy. When relationships are healthy, businesses and careers flourish. And it really impacts all of a community and society as a whole, starting with what's on the end of your fork, starting with what activities you decided to participate in, and just as importantly, not participate in. And when you ask why, as a Western-trained MD, this is so unusual, it's because throughout all of our medical training, we don't get a peep about what we now term lifestyle medicine. We never heard anything about the power of food. We never heard anything about the health damaging effects of certain foods, right? And then the health thriving effects of others. And we didn't really get much about how our lifestyles, our choices about how to manage things like weight and exercise and alcohol and emotional mindset and environmental toxicities, how important those are in the balance of health versus illness.
You know, the educational work you're doing, it really is supremely important. I'm sure the surgery work you do also is. But I want to focus on the educational work because I think it is so important. And because many women today believe that it's family history and it's genetics that determine who gets breast cancer and who doesn't. You've pointed out that that's not really true, that inherited mutations only cause maybe 5 or 10% of all breast cancer cases. I actually remember you telling me that 87% of women who are diagnosed with breast cancer don't have even a single first-degree relative with breast cancer.
That's correct.
But for some reason, when we go to see physicians, we're almost always asked about our family medical history. We're asked about whether our parents or siblings have had this or that disease. I'm sure women are asked whether their parents or mother or sisters have had breast cancer, but we're almost never asked about our diets. And this contributes to the false idea that breast cancer occurs primarily as a result of family history or maybe environmental factors like stress or just fate. I mean, factors that are predominantly outside our direct control. Christy, if a woman exercises regularly, if she doesn't smoke, and instead of eating meat and dairy and processed food, she shifts her diet towards whole food, plant-based eating, what actually happens to her odds of getting breast cancer?
Her odds are slashed by a solid 50, if not up to 80 or 90%, just by implementing scientifically, rigorously researched, proven changes to her diet and her lifestyle. So exercising regularly, limiting or eliminating alcohol, and predominantly eating a plant-based diet has everything to do between sickness and health. It's sad to me that there is such an emphasis on inherited genetic mutations. It's important, don't get me wrong, they exist. And literally 5 to 10% of all breast cancer on the planet can be attributed to inherited genetic mutations, things like BRCA or BRCA, CHEK2, PALB2. And a simple spit test, saliva can tell us whether or not you carry one of these gene mutations. But as you pointed out, that I had pointed out, 87% of women diagnosed don't have a single first-degree relative with breast cancer. And get this, 80% of all women diagnosed don't have any relatives, second or third or, you know, and so on generations. So for the vast majority, breast cancer is not a disease determined at the time of your birth by something congenital over which you had no control. It is, in fact, an accumulation of insults to your body. The initiation of a cancer cell, what changes it from normal to abnormal, be it, say, UV rays causing a melanoma change, right? Or dietary factors causing a breast cell to go awry. Or radiation, we know all too well from something, catastrophic radiation doses like Chernobyl or atomic bombs exploding, that radiation has extreme detrimental effects on causing cancer to those on the outskirts, right? They continue to live, but then they have an abundance of cancers develop. But what about medical x-rays, right? That radiation. So you've created a cancer cell, but so what? Do you know how it needs so much fuel in order to propagate, for one cell to become two, to become four, to become eight? It needs an environment filled with inflammation and free radicals and oxidative stress. When it comes to breast cancer, probably 80% of them thrive and require extra levels of estrogen, growth hormones, angiogenesis, the ability to bring blood flow to it so that it can grab all the nutrients it needs to then live in this world where the abnormal cell growing without control or order can become an actual definable cancer that, boom, through that angiogenesis, through those blood vessels, straight out to liver, lung, brain, or bone, metastasizes somewhere. That process, that is at least 5 years, if not 10 or 20 in the making. So cell initiation is not the problem, it's promotion. So that's where control comes in. Even with a genetic mutation, promotion requires that microenvironment that a tumor cell requires in order to gain the fuels and the necessary nutrients it needs to persist and multiply. And that's where all of our control can be aimed, is in stopping promotion. Live a life that screams out anti-cancer inside your cells, not pro-cancer.
Well, for a woman to know what to do to live a life so her cells are screaming anti-cancer and defeating any cancer, rather than promoting any cancer cells that might have developed, a lot of women are hampered by a dangerous falsehood that circulates in our society, and that is that your diet just doesn't impact breast health. Now, that idea may be completely false. In fact, it is. It is false, but it is very widely held. I saw a poll that found that only 23% of American women are aware that there are any dietary steps that they could take that would lower their chances of developing breast cancer. And among women with less than a high school education, only 3% are aware that what they eat has any effect on their risk. If the idea that what we eat doesn't affect our odds of developing cancer is totally wrong, and I agree with you that it is, Christy, what's the truth then? Just how important is what women eat to their breast health?
What I would love more than anything else for the 77% of women who who did not think that diet had an impact, for them to understand is that some of the most powerful compounds on planet Earth, just as or potentially more powerful than the chemotherapy and other extremely toxic medications and therapies that would be offered to you as someone newly diagnosed with cancer, just as or more powerful than those with extreme collateral damage, come compounds dwelling inside of plants that, frankly, some of the pharmaceutical industries have extracted and adulterated and then sold back to you for $75,000 a shot. Literally, they come from plants. So if you think about a plant, it behaves like this little pharmacy, right? It's auto-dispensing molecules that kill off bacteria, viruses, and fungi before attackers can kill them. They preceded us as humans on Earth, and they developed this awesome weaponry to protect themselves against adversaries like the UV rays from the sun or microorganisms, right, in bugs. So let me think about that. If I were to chew and swallow a plant as a human, would those protective powers then be transferred to me? They absolutely would. I mean, the medicinal gifts of the Amazon provide the basis for countless medications that pharmaceutical companies sell. So the plant compounds, which have very chemical sounding names like the sulforaphane and indole-3-carbinol in broccoli and the genistein in soy and the ellagic acid in berries and walnuts, have the power to block carcinogenic action, to block the creation of cancer cells. And with that power, literally comes the ability of plants to prevent the formation of cancer cells inside of you. Now, not every time, because the milieu, your microenvironment, is affected by many things and by many decades of perhaps consuming and behaving in ways that are more pro-cancer than anti. So just like, you know, one day of eating a bunch of berries and flax seeds is not going to confer total protection. What people should really digest and understand is that robust research reveals that these plant-based chemicals, these phytonutrients, exude anti-cancer powers in very tangible, normal word ways. They prevent DNA damage. They repair broken DNA. They destroy harmful cells in your body. They temper the growth rate of cancer cells. They inhibit the new blood supply that comes to tumor cells that we call angiogenesis. And inhibiting it is anti-angiogenesis, which is the power that plants exert. They stimulate your immune system like, hey, wake up, recognize that that cell doesn't belong here. It's damaged. It's deranged. It is not following the orders of the body and needs to be removed. Berries have the ability to create apoptosis inside a cancer cell. Apoptosis is a fancy doctor term for cancer cell suicide. And eating a bunch of berries will release chemicals that get absorbed into your bloodstream, go coursing through your veins, identify, seek out, and destroy cancer cells by making them kill themselves. So plants are so powerful. And when women start to understand that, especially since they are more often than not the ones feeding a family, wow, we can really get into the grassroots of this country where the food is being placed on the table and that food has the power to heal, the power to slow, stop, and even reverse all of life's major killers.
You know, your patients may follow your advice and adopt an anti-cancer diet, a whole foods plant-based diet, because they've learned that this will dramatically reduce their breast cancer risk. But I'm hearing from you that thinking that their health would improve in other ways may not be on their mind as much, but it will happen. Their risk for many other diseases will be reduced besides cancer. Christy, what are some of the other health benefits that women can expect to experience when they adopt the diet you recommend?
Oh my gosh, it's so funny. It's all the stuff there. It's beyond health. It maximally creates this most joyful life where you live the most fruitful, bountiful existence you ever thought possible, because not only will living a whole food plant-based life and then maintaining a healthy weight and minimizing or eliminating alcohol, will it stave off a future breast cancer diagnosis or potential recurrence if you're already a thriver? It literally leads to lower cholesterol, better triglycerides, perfect blood pressure, fewer heart attacks, a leaner body, less diabetes, painless joints, more energy, better sleep, a happier mood, an improved sex life, a sharper mind, less dementia, And then things that all women just love, a few vain benefits, right? You're going to have smoother skin, fewer wrinkles, the emancipation that comes with regular bowel movements from being bloated and gassy. You're going to have cleaner lungs, literally less cancers in every organ of your body. And you will be contributing by behaving this way to a healthier planet. Leaving the planet healthier is the biggest side benefit that I never saw coming.
Well, it is the healthiest way to live for ourselves and for the planet and for the animals, the whole web of life, really. The whole fate of the earth in some ways lies on in our hands when we eat in ways that we sometimes don't see. There's a lot of cultural resistance sometimes to this. There are so many benefits, but there are these levels of intractable resistance. Now, you spoke a moment ago of transitioning yourself and your husband and your children to this way of eating. And I know that you and your family haven't always eaten the way you now do. Your husband, Andy, is a competitive triathlete. You've got three kids. Christy, when you and your family shifted your diets, what was that like for all of you? What happened to your family's health? And what happened to Andy's athletic performance?
Well, so this was in the midst of writing Breast the Owner's Manual, the book that came out in 2018. This moment, this epiphany, when I did a deep dive into nutritional science, left me, because of my personality, no real choice other than to just like, wham, bam, today. If I had been convinced, I had seen the rock solid evidence and I couldn't convince myself that another way of eating would be healthier than whole food plant-based. Kids came home from school. I ran down the stairs and with terrific drama and flair, I flung open the refrigerator doors and declared, "Boys, come here. We're going vegan." And they were like, "Yeah, what is vegan?" I don't know if it's the surgeon in me, but it's like, if I know and believe that this is ultimately the absolute best way, why would I do anything less than my best, right? So we went completely in 1 minute, boom, all the way to whole food plant-based. But transition steps and altering meals to be predominantly that way and a few completely here and there are so laudable and will still go a tremendous way toward promoting health and staving off illness. So we transitioned immediately. The boys, I'll be totally transparent here, they were down with it. They got it. We watched What the Health that very night. I wanted them to understand that the perspective from which we were changing, and this is not going to be a pendulum swinging in mom's life, you know, and that I changed back to a different way in a month. And they did understand the health effects. And then we watched a few other documentaries so they could understand the environmental effects of eating whole food plant-based versus having a more carnivorous appetite. But they looked at tofu and flicked it off the plate and were like, So I had a little challenge in the beginning. I'm like, ooh, I'm going to become that parent in the news, this doctor whose children are malnourished because of how she feeds them. So they weren't readily accepting much more than rice and beans for a minute there. But I'll tell you, it's not a trick. It's a truth. Your taste bud cells repopulate every 10 days. So I told them, the last time that you tried lentils was 12 days ago. So it's time for another bite, my friend. So they transitioned slowly but steadily. And I would say they're completely like fully balanced with their eating now. It's gorgeous to see. And they eat pretty much everything I cook. Andy took a downturn in the first 6 months of going totally whole food plant-based. He couldn't quite, we think, figure out some of the electrolytes, and he felt a little weaker after his next Ironman, full Ironman race. But he tweaked it, and now, again, being up on 3 years later, he's stronger than ever, faster than ever. So he's beyond his peak of fitness on a whole food plant-based diet.
Wow. Wow. Setting personal records for himself at a very high level, I might add.
Exactly.
Yeah. You mentioned tofu, and you were speaking about the fact that your family transitioned to a whole foods plant-based diet as a result of what you were learning, really, while you were doing the research for your excellent book. there is a lot of controversy surrounding tofu and soy foods, really, mostly due to the compounds in soy that can bind to estrogen receptors. Now, some people take this very seriously, and they are concerned that even moderate amounts of soy could increase the risk of breast cancer or be harmful to women with breast cancer, and especially so if their cancer is estrogen receptor positive. Now, Christy, this is an important topic, and I know it's one that you've researched in great depth. Can you help us understand what the truth is about soy? Can you set the record straight about soy?
Ah, I'd love to, and thank you for asking. So first off, apologies for 19 years of giving you false information about avoiding soy. I was the breast cancer surgeon out there saying, you know what? We know that soy contains isoflavones, some of which act like phytoestrogens, these plant-based estrogen-like compounds, and they have very near identical chemical structure to the estrogen in your body. So, you know, 80% of all breast cancer cells have a little receptor sitting on them for estrogen. And when estrogen hits that receptor, it will send a signal to the cancer cell to multiply and divide. Well, we don't know if these plant estrogens are just doing the same thing, filling the receptors. So how much do you like tofu? Spit that miso out of your mouth, right? Like, I was militant about get rid of the soy. Okay, I go to write the book, deep dive into the science to literally pull the scientific facts for my position out of the literature and put it in the book. And ooh, that's where I realized I was embarrassingly wrong, because in point of fact, and here it is, I'm going to make this simple, understandable, and it will be a massive aha moment for, I hope, the majority of listeners who are still on the fence about soy. You have two receptors in your body for estrogen, alpha and beta. Alpha is attached to the cancer cells, but with 1,600% more affinity, the phytoestrogens in soy products bind to beta receptors. And what that activates is fascinating. Number one, activated beta receptors shut alpha down. So it literally takes away the activity of the cancer receptor. And it goes flying out into your body to your fat cells, where everywhere you have a fat cell, you have an enzyme inside of it called aromatase, busily churning away hormones from your adrenal gland, like androstenedione and testosterone, into estrogen. Soy, via the beta receptor, goes out and inactivates the aromatase. So now you're getting less conversion of other hormones into estrogen. So you're decreasing your estrogen that can fuel the alpha receptor. Well, wait a minute. So wait, but I said mostly it hits beta. What does soy do when it does hit alpha? Is it bad there? Well, it activates that receptor literally with 1/10 to 1/100th of the capacity of your actual estrogen. So now it's acting like a molecule, some listeners may know, tamoxifen. This is a very commonly used breast cancer anti-estrogen drug that hits a receptor like a car sitting in the parking space you wanted so badly, and it just sits there and blocks it, but it really doesn't have much downstream activity. So soy is not only safe to consume, it's beneficial to consume. But before 2009, the literature had never reported any good longitudinal studies looking at the health effects of soy consumption in cancer patients. So, okay, we know it's safe for women to take, and it actually can decrease breast cancer risk. There was a really large study that looked at over 73,000 Chinese women that concluded that consuming soy protected against breast cancer by the tune of 58% reduction. So that was a big, like, help to reduce risk study that was, you know, very robust with 73,000. But what if you already had it? We weren't sure until 2009, and then the LACE study came out, the Life After Cancer Epidemiology Study, followed almost 2,000 multi-ethnic survivors, so not just those of Asian descent, and they were literally on tamoxifen. And they then divided out those who had the most versus least tofu and soy milk products in their diets, and those consuming soy had a 60% reduction in breast cancer recurrence compared to women with low soy amounts. And furthermore, they had 29% less death from breast cancer. Then the largest study about soy to date in breast cancer patients came out a couple years later. It followed 6,200 multi-ethnic women from the United States and Canada for over 9 years. And again, those consuming soy, and this was hardly any, this was a half to one serving a week. I counsel people to have 2 to 3 servings a day of soy products, but this was just a half serving, 21% decrease in all-cause mortality, that's death, and a 51% drop in estrogen negative cancers and a 32% drop in estrogen driven cancers. So, and there are about 5 more studies that keep hounding the same point over and over. So it's very, very safe phytonutrient to consume. And I advise people to consume 2 to 3 servings every single day. When I talk about soy products, I do want people making sure it's all non-GMO. 100% organic even goes a step above, but non-GMO is important. And it's not hard to find, and it's not expensive. I mean, an organic package of tofu is like $1.99. So this is very reasonably priced, highly complete protein, by the way, has all of the essential amino acids. It's just a really healthful food that is sadly lacking from too many people's diets because of misinformation.
You referred a moment ago to what is called the Shanghai Women's Health Study. This is the study that followed about 73,000 Chinese women, and they followed them for about 7 years. It's considered to be the largest and most detailed study of soy and breast cancer risk in a population with high soy consumption ever undertaken. So if we want to know what's the effect of high soy consumption on breast cancer risk, this is the study. This is the definitive study. And in this study, as you alluded to, women who ate the most soy had a 58% lower risk of premenopausal breast cancer compared with those who ate the lowest amounts of soy. So I think this completely corroborates what you're saying about soy and breast cancer. And yet, prior to doing the research that led to your book, you, as you've said, you had a different idea. It wasn't based in science, but it led you to actually counsel your patients in accord with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
What has happened in our culture such that even a very knowledgeable, informed, and caring doctor could have been as misled, in this case about soy, as you were?
Unfortunately, I think a lot of doctors stick with some passing comment that a revered attending doctor may have told them when they were passing through their medical school or residency days. And that's it. That's where the research and the curiosity stopped. Another mistake that we doctors and all people can make is to know just a little bit and to buy it hook, line, and sinker. For example, if you look back at the earlier soy studies that were published, there's some in petri dishes, there's some in mice. They would put grafted breast cancers onto mice and feed them soy, and 10% of the cancers would grow. Well, I had heard about that study and I thought to myself, whoa, my patients may be in the 10%. How much, they can't have soy because it might make their cancer grow. But it turns out that mice and women don't always behave the same way and have the same reactions to food when they have a breast cancer. So this particular example is one where we don't behave like mice. And soy never makes a breast cancer grow inside of a human being. And that goes for our male listeners. When they worry, oh, I don't want to get man boobs, which I call gynecomastia, right? Or there are some, they worry about infertility. It's quite the opposite. Those men who consume a reasonable 2 to 3 servings a day actually have an increase in fertility. There's been no evidence. These are case reports, okay? I'm into science. I'm into big numbers, not some wow factor of a man who drank a gallon of soy a day and can fit into a B cup raw now.
Well, I read your books and I loved it so much. Your book is titled Breasts and Owner's Manual, and a very substantial part of it is devoted to helping women to reduce the risk of breast cancer through intelligent and wise food choices. And you list 10 breast superfoods, and that list starts with cruciferous vegetables and leafy greens. And cruciferous veggies, of course, are those in the cabbage family. And this includes broccoli and kale and collards and arugula and mustard greens and bok choy and others. And one of the reasons these particular veggies are so protective against cancer is the isothiocyanates they contain. And the superstar of all the isothiocyanates is a substance you mentioned a few minutes ago, sulforaphane.
Mm-hmm.
Christy, what do people need to know about sulforaphane and about the anti-cancer power of the veggies, all of the veggies in the cabbage family?
Oh, so in the cabbage family, this is such a nice little take-home point for people to know. When you chew these foods, it is important, imperative, in order to get all the most bang from your brock, as I say, is to eat them raw or lightly steamed. Now, you don't have to eat every bit completely raw. Let me tell you the reasoning behind it and then the workaround. When you break down the cell walls of the cruciferous vegetable family foods, you are going to release an enzyme called myrosinase, which is required to transform that chemical that you mentioned, isothiocyanate, into the one that I love called sulforaphane. You need the chemical. The chemical is destroyed by heat. So whenever you deliciously roast your broccoli, boom, you lose the myrosinase and you can't make sulforaphane. So why do you care? Sulforaphanes are amazing. They display insane talent at seeking out and destroying breast cancer cells, right? The whole apoptosis thing and annihilating cancers. And by the way, broccoli sprouts contain 100 times the sulforaphane component of broccoli, but broccoli is still amazing. So what you do is you cook your broccoli however you might want, if you're just like, you know, roasted broccoli is the bomb, but sprinkle some raw chopped broccoli on top or mustard seed. You can take mustard powder. It has myrosinase, and you can just do literally a pinch, and studies showed that that was enough myrosinase. Or mix in some raw arugula or something with your cooked food so that you can get all of the benefits from those powerful sulforaphanes. The same story is true with different fancy words of the allium family, right? So we've got their onions and scallions and all of the garlics, leeks, shallots, right? Those guys, chives, you want to crush them or chop them, but they also have to be fresh to unleash their anti-proliferative and antioxidant protection. This phytochemical allicin also gets destroyed by heat, but there you go. So now you can use your workaround there. If you like to saute or cook your onions, then just chop up some raw ones and add them into the final mix or puree them. You puree them, you lyse the cells and you don't cook, heat destroy the cells. So you get that compound released. Alienase is the name of that one.
Well, the onion family and the cabbage family are both fabulous anti-cancer families of foods. And they bestow so many other benefits to us, as well as being anti-cancer, that they, I think they belong in everybody's diet. And there's another food, I don't know whether it is actually a vegetable technically, that I think belongs in everybody's diet, at least to some degree, and that's the fungi, mushrooms. You mentioned aromatase earlier. Mushrooms contain aromatase inhibitors. These are estrogen-blocking compounds, and this makes them, to my eyes, very potent anti-cancer foods for both men and women. In men, they keep testosterone and other androgens from being converted into estrogens, and they thus improve testosterone levels, particularly in older men where it's much appreciated. And so if I were designing the ultimate anti-cancer diet, I would include mushrooms. And I would include even the common white button mushrooms, not just the fancier, more expensive types, the medicinal mushrooms.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you would include if you were designing your ultimate anti-cancer diet?
I absolutely would. And that little white button carries the highest estrogen blocking ability of all the mushrooms. It literally
outcompetes,
yeah, the portobello and chanterelle or those medicinal mushrooms that you mentioned, like reishi and turkey tail, shiitake. Yeah, that little old white button. And guess what? It only takes 10 grams. And people are like, I have no idea how much that is. That would be the equivalent of your thumb. A thumb's worth of white button mushroom has the ability, in a large study looking at Chinese women, to drop cancer, breast cancer rates by 64% compared to age-matched no mushroom eaters. And in those women who also sipped on just a half a cup of green tea, and we can talk more about the merits of green tea, but they dropped their breast cancer rates by 89%. A mushroom and some tea. Now, there is a toxin called agaritin that exists in all raw mushrooms. So this is not a factoid in my book because I learned it after I wrote it. Now I've always just lightly cook, saute, steam somehow for 60 seconds. That's all it takes to blow the agaritin off. But all those raw mushrooms chopped on all those salad bars, yeah, Toxins.
You've mentioned alcohol a couple of times. There is a widely believed idea that moderate amounts of alcohol, particularly red wine, can be beneficial. But you've written that of all the controllable risk factors for breast cancer, none is more prevalent across diverse populations and cultures than alcohol. Now, Christy, my read of the scientific literature tells me that almost any amount of alcohol can actually increase cancer risk. It's obvious to all of us what excess alcohol and alcoholism does. But my take from reading the literature is that any amount of alcohol can actually start to increase cancer risk. What's the truth about the role of alcohol in breast cancer risk?
Right. So yeah, it's important to note that the IARC, the official World Health Organization division that decides what causes cancer, has concluded that all alcoholic beverages are carcinogenic to humans. So it's never to be, you know, consumed in excess, but you're asking, can it be even consumed in any amount in a safe way? Well, yes, and it's probably, according to my deep dive into looking at alcohol, limited to red wine. And the effect there comes from resveratrol, which is the phytonutrient found in the skin of red grapes, the ones with the seeds. So if you want any of the benefits that I might enumerate in a minute, you can get them by chomping on some fresh, organic, preferably red grapes, the ones with the seeds. You don't have to drink wine because it's in the skin of the grapes. But resveratrol is actually the subject of a number of very interesting anti-cancer, cancer treatment studies in the United States right now, because it is such a powerful compound as it relates to breast cancer when it comes to reducing inflammation inside your body. And the other component of red wine behaves like an aromatase inhibitor. There was one study that looked at all cancers, mouth, esophagus, liver, colon, breast, and all-cause mortality. And the only subset that was okay was coming from those who consumed between 4 to 8 ounces of red wine a day. They actually had a decrease in all cancer relative to teetotalers. And every other alcohol made their outcomes worse. So it might be okay, especially on a special occasion, to enjoy a glass of red wine now and again. There's a whole host of reasons why alcohol leads to illness and a number of cancers, but red wine might be the one exception.
I'd like to ask you about coffee and cancer. It appears to me that drinking a number of cups of coffee a day can actually reduce the risk of breast cancer, as well as other forms of cancer. But that benefit may be only true about lean women. Paradoxically, and for some reason that I don't fully understand, drinking the same amount of coffee seems to increase the risk of breast cancer in obese women. Christy, can you shed some light on this topic and also talk about green tea as well as coffee?
Yeah, great. So it's so interesting about coffee that it does have some benefits. It can cause breast pain and breast cysts and breast swelling and exacerbate the breast effects of PMS. So if you notice that association, don't fret. It's not your breast whispering at you or maybe screaming at you that they don't like coffee because they're making a cancerous change. That's not happening. But if your breasts are affected by coffee in that way with pain and swelling, you know, you probably should switch to decaf or stop coffee. But there are some coffee-induced benefits. For example, there's one study that looks at 5 cups a day and achieved a 59% reduction in estrogen-negative cancers. So we've been talking a lot, especially in the soy conversation, about how 80% of cancers are fed and fueled by estrogen, which conversely means 20% could care less about estrogen. They're estrogen-negative. And we don't really understand those as well. They're definitely much more aggressive, harder to treat, have a worse survival rate. Triple negative cancer actually has the worst survival rate, second to inflammatory breast cancer. So it's pretty striking and awesome to think that 5 cups of coffee can drop estrogen negative cancer formation by 59%. In the BRCA gene mutation carriers, there was a study that looked at high coffee consumption. This was now 6 cups a day, but they had a 69% drop in cancer, which is amazing because you're talking about a mutation that you would think a woman would be kind of at the mercy of those DNA breaks and the inability to repair them, which is what happens when you have a BRCA mutation. So we think that the benefits of coffee come from the compound called methylxanthine. They might interfere with the causation of cancer somehow, but here's where that ironic twist comes in with those who are overweight or obese. So being overweight or obese in adolescence and young adulthood confers a protective effect against breast cancer, but only premenopausal breast cancer, which you should realize 20% of all breast cancer happens before age 50, 80% after 50. So the vast majority of your risk is after 50, and it's no good to be overweight at that time because you're producing too much estrogen and fueling cancers. So all that to say, it's probably not a good strategy to purposely be an obese adolescent, all in the name of breast cancer prevention. But something odd happens when you're overweight and premenopausal that it protects against cancer. And we don't really understand it, but we think it has some sort of interaction with the ovary and its production. And that interaction with the ovary is negated. The helpful interaction is negated by the methylxanthines in coffee. So that's the best we can do to try to understand why drinking coffee in overweight and obese women leads to an increase in cancer. So the green tea is incredible to me. I kind of have a sweet smile on my face whenever I talk about tea, because it was like the harbinger to my future self. I knew 25 years ago, I had done, for whatever reason, I was researching tea and its effects on breast cancer, and found out that 3 cups of green tea a day can slash breast cancer incidence in half. And squeezing some lemon into your tea can potentiate the EGCG compound, the antioxidant epigallocatechin gallate. There's a mouthful. EGCG will increase fivefold with the squeeze of lemon. So I, for decades now, would just take 3 cups of green tea every day at noon, plug and chug them down with a squeeze of lemon. And I had to plug my nose because I really hated the taste of green tea. Over the years, I've actually kind of developed my palate a bit, but that's how powerful this tea is. A 50% reduction. And there are even more studies that go into those who already have an existing cancer diagnosis. For example, there was one with women who had a stage 1 breast cancer, and this is Japanese women, and they had a 57% decrease in recurrence for drinking just 3 cups of green tea a day. And stage 2 breast cancer is 31% decrease. So there are some amazing anti-carcinogenic powers to the EGCG in green tea.
As I hear you talk about the wonders and the anti-cancer powers of the cabbage and onion family, of berries and mushrooms, even the common, and maybe especially the common button mushroom and green tea, I hear the underlying theme that every woman has the power to reduce her breast cancer risk significantly, majorly, in achievable ways, in dramatic ways, and that this is all backed up by rigorous scientific research. So, Christy, this strikes me as very important information to have, and I'm glad you're speaking about it. I'm glad that you're bringing it to our audience. And yet, I don't think anybody wants to make cancer patients feel guilty for somehow having caused their disease. You've written that most of your patients who heed your advice feel empowered. They feel relieved. They appreciate knowing what they can do. But what I want to ask you is, when you're treating a woman who has breast cancer, how do you help her to understand the power of her food and lifestyle choices without making her feel guilty for whatever choices she may have made in the past?
So that's a great question, and it can be a very delicate one, especially when you're talking to someone who's diagnosed with an advanced stage, and we're not really sure an absolute cure is on the horizon for her, right? It becomes much, much more of a delicate conversation. And I never accuse, blame, or criticize, which, by the way, is called the ABCs of a surgeon. They like to accuse, blame, and criticize. Yes. If you know any surgeons in your life, you might want to keep that one silently to yourself. But the point is, when I meet with women, they are at this beautiful convergence most of the time of having a receptive heart and not being defensive about what might have been ignorance, the simple, and why ignorant? I just mean not knowing, lacking information and knowledge. But now they're at a crossroads in life where they are very receptive to receiving new information and knowledge, especially when that is believed to be life-sustaining and healing. In the women who, quote unquote, kind of do everything right, right? They exercise well and they're thin and they've eaten well, or so they thought. I find that even they are even more motivated to kind of dive into the details of their every day-to-day life and the choices that they're making, because they thought they purposefully had engineered their lives to make the correct choices. And yet, darn it, here we are with a cancer diagnosis. So I find for pretty much every patient, really, that they can't wait to understand what they can do beyond the surgery, radiation, chemo, and anti-estrogen pills and targeted therapies and all the beautiful things that Western medicine can bring to this stage of trying to cure the cancer. But it all has collateral damage, and it all has a finite period of time in which you're taking it, right? What happens when it's all done? And then you're just, boop, cut loose. Like, okay, most doctors are going to tell you when you're done with your Western journey, oh, you did everything right. You did everything you were supposed to do. Don't you worry about a thing. You go back to your life and just live. And while that's meant to be encouraging, wow, that's really horrible. You mean, because I was just living before and I ended up with the cancer. So I find that we can delve into the nitty-gritty of diet. And even for a very clean eater, there are some potent, oh, here's a couple examples. I have a list of 6 anti-estrogenic foods. If you have an estrogen-driven cancer, let's make sure you're getting these 6 things in your diet pretty much every single day. And they're totally obtainable goals. We want a couple of servings of cruciferous vegetables. We want 2 to 3 servings of soy. We want that half of a button mushroom every day, right? The mushrooms. We have some citrus in there and fiber. And flax seeds, and those are my top 6. Very well researched, very proven to reduce the estrogen burden in your bodies. Yeah, but the majority of the women I'm talking to are not purposefully putting in 1 to 2 tablespoons of ground flax seeds into their diet every day, right? So there's enough that I can do on the nutrition front, even in somebody who's already like 90% of the way there, to optimize nutrition. But man, there's so much to talk about when it comes to, and I'm going to tell you these 2 things: environmental toxicities and emotional stress. Most of us, even a 30-year-old with breast cancer, right? She hasn't even lived long enough, long enough to have all these DNA breakages accumulate, and yet here she is. She might feel helpless. But then when we start talking about meditation and the benefits of meditation and the scientifically shown decrease in inflammatory markers inside your bloodstream when you meditate, boom, there's a whole new strategy she can incorporate. So I approach all of my patients without judgment, but at the very end of the day, if they're willing to hear it, I'm not actually trying to blame, but I'm trying to say, hey, look, you know, you're up 20 pounds. That helped this cancer survive and thrive. So let's lose it. Let's drop 10. And here's how. And we create a real actionable, doable plan to achieve these goals that will lead them to their most fruitful, happiest lives.
Well, Christy, if surgeons deserve, and I'm sure some regrettably do, the ABC that they accuse and blame and criticize, I think in your case, what I hear is you're appreciating and you're blessing and you're caring.
Thank you. I try.
You do. You more than try. And you're so generous in how much you share and give. I have the impression, I mentioned this earlier, that your ultimate mission as a physician is to do everything you can to teach women about breast health, to help them to take charge of their overall health, and to understand what they can do to reduce their cancer risk. And I hear you telling us that every single day we make countless choices that either bring us closer to cancer or move us further away, and that what we eat can either fuel cancer cells or help our bodies to seek and destroy them, and that by eating whole and colorful plant foods, we really do help our bodies to defend themselves to the max. Christy, it has been a great pleasure for me to speak with you today. And on behalf of Ocean and myself, and really everyone involved in the food revolution, and all women, and everyone who has breasts, I thank you for your outstanding work and your deep caring, and of course, for being with us today.
Oh, and I thank you for all that you do in your life, John, and Ocean. And I thank the Food Revolution for inviting me back.
We've been talking with Dr. Christy Funk, founder of the Pink Lotus Breast Center and author of Breasts, an Owner's Manual. Christy, you're one of the most accomplished breast cancer surgeons in the world. You've walked thousands of women through one of the most challenging moments of their lives. And now you're helping all of us with your brilliant insights, your wise guidance, and your eloquent passion. We are so grateful for your partnership in the food revolution.
Thank you.